Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me today is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm good, Robert. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Good work last week on your show with Andrew. I really
Thank
enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I got a lot of compliments on it. But today, we have a new show. And longtime listeners of My Old Kentucky Podcast know that we make no attempt to hide our political preferences. But as people who are concerned about policymaking in the Commonwealth of Kentucky, it only makes sense for us to talk to leaders of the Republican Party who control both chambers of the legislature and the governorship. So today, we are going to have Whitney Westerfield, a Republican senator from Hopkinsville, on the show. Senator Westerfield's district covers Christian, Todd, and Logan counties. If you know Kentucky geography, it's on the southern border of Kentucky, across from Clarksville, Tennessee, just east of the Jackson Purchase in far western Kentucky. So Senator Westerfield won a seat in 2012 in the closest Senate race that year. 3 years later, Senator Westerfield was in another very close election where he was the Republican nominee for the Attorney General and lost to Andy Beshear by about 2,000 votes, which equated to about 0.2%. In the most recent General Assembly, Senator Westerfield was the chief sponsor of SB 120, which was a criminal justice reform bill that became law after it was overwhelmingly supported by both parties. So today we're going to be talking to Senator Westerfield about that bill and criminal justice writ large. So Senator Westerfield, welcome to My Old Kentucky Podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Robert, Jasmine, glad to be here. Hopefully your listeners haven't stopped the podcast playback. Yeah. If you're still there, stay with us. I promise not to say anything too crazy. Or at least I'm not going to aim to anyway.
Oh man, we hope you say something crazy, because then we get all kinds of new listeners. People would be like, "Oh
yeah,
my gosh,
right.
Can't you believe what this elected official said?" Again, thank you so much. So, just to lead off, you were 32 years old when you won your first seat in the legislature, defeating a 10-year incumbent at that time. 3 years later, you were 35 and you ran for statewide office. So has being an elected member of Kentucky's government always been something you aspire to do?
Not necessarily that specifically. I was actually 31
when
on election day in 2012. I hadn't yet turned 32, and the incumbent had been a 20-year incumbent.
Wow.
And you're right, it was a razor-thin margin, but you just need the one vote, and thankfully I had 296 extra. But to answer your question, it was something that I had aspired to, but not necessarily the legislative branch in particular. I didn't think about being a state senator. In fact, there was a time when I had considered running for the state house before running for the Senate and decided against it, prayed quite a bit, and felt like God was saying, not yet, this is not what you're supposed to be doing. And I was very content with that decision, and obviously he provided a victory in 2012 that no one expected, outside of maybe my wife and me, and I'm grateful for it, and hopefully I've done at least a little bit of good while I've had the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know that it's something that's pretty common on the Democratic side of the aisle, that sometimes people use the word ambitious to connote some sort of character flaw among people. I don't know how Jasmine feels, but I personally think that's pretty ridiculous, because you don't want like reluctant public servants. You want people who are like really excited about doing it and wanting to advance in their career. I don't know. Have you dealt with people saying that about you and your career, or is this something that's unique to our side?
No. Unfortunately, it is not unique to the Democratic Party. It is similar, at least in my experience, in the Republican Party. I mean, you have people who question your motives all the time, and they'd question your motives and my motives, whether I was in office or not. But being in office obviously raises your profile a bit, no matter what office it is, from city council to president of the United States. You've decided to step out and become a more public figure in some regard. And so you're scrutinized a little bit more, and your motives for doing things are scrutinized. And I think you're right. Ambition does seem to carry with it a connotation of, I'll say, conniving, or maybe not manipulative, maybe Machiavellian, but not necessarily as pure as certainly the word ought to mean. And I think you're right also that it's important we have people that actually want to do the jobs that they seek. Not only that they're experienced, not only that they bring to bear some quality that improves the work of that particular position, but that they have a desire to do it. I think, though, it's been soured by people who very clearly were running for one thing with clear eyes on running for something else. And that's also true in both parties. I think you can find that. And I think it also shows in the performance of the first job.
Sure.
If it's only supposed to be a springboard, then they sort of just pay it lip service, and it's not something they devote themselves to as much as all of us voters would have them do.
Right. I mean, it's kind of interesting to me that when I was much younger, I would look at the legislature and people that were running for office, and it would always be the Democrats that were always, you know, thought of as more ambitious because they were, you know, up until then had all of the...
That's just because you were around more Democrats than Republicans.
Well, I mean, back in like the 90s and such, you know, everybody just assumed that all the statewide positions were going to go to Democrats, and there's a little bit of a ceiling for Republicans. And I kind of feel like it may be the case right now that there certainly is a little bit of a ceiling on Democrats, even though not all of them seem to realize that quite yet. So it's, now we get the same sort of situation with Republicans who have their eyes on bigger prizes. And watching that kind of develop as more Republicans have realized that, you know, there's places to go here. We could actually win many, many elections, that we don't just have to be sacrificial lambs anymore, and realize that that's something they can aspire to. It's been something interesting to look at. It's kind of silly that people look at younger people and say, you know, oh, gosh, I can't believe you're trying.
Well, the alternative is we let government be run by a slew of very already wealthy retirees.
Absolutely.
And they certainly bring wisdom and experience that youth does not and cannot compete with. But they don't see the world the same way that people who are younger see it. And sometimes they've forgotten what it's like to see the world from 35 or 31 or even younger than that. And it's good to have a healthy mix. I'm actually really proud of the mix we have in the state Senate. With my year of folks coming in 2013, that January, really brought the average age down quite a bit. I was actually going to be the youngest in the Senate, and then Sarah Beth Gregory won that special election for the former Senate President, then Circuit Judge David Williams' seat in the 16th district, and she actually became the youngest member of the Senate.
Yeah.
So Morgan McGarvey, mm-hmm. same age as me. You know, I mean, we really brought the age range down, the average down.
Yeah, you're not the youngest legislator we've interviewed on the show. We had Mackenzie Cantrell on a couple weeks ago, and I believe she's 29. So there you
honestly
go.
I didn't know how old she was.
Oh, man. I hope she's not mad at me.
You just broke a cardinal rule, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's public information, but yeah. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about justice, Jasmine.
Okay, criminal justice specifically is what we're here to talk to you about today, Senator Westerfield. So you sponsored Senate Bill 120, which has a lot of parts to it, but I guess in general I'd call it sort of a reentry bill for our listeners. It prevents an automatic ban on occupational licenses. It creates a substance abuse pilot program for people on parole and good behavior credits for people on parole. It also allows jails to operate day reporting centers, and it allows some private companies to provide jobs in prison, etc. So despite all of these big reforms, compared to what the CJ PAC was considering, which included bail reform, raising felony theft thresholds, reforming PFO law, this bill seems somewhat less ambitious than people thought it might be. Tell us a little bit about the process of passing this bill and why it may have been scaled back from the original drafts.
Well, it wasn't that it may have been scaled back. It absolutely was scaled back from early drafts.
Sure.
That were much more ambitious and aggressive in terms of the reforms that we sought to do. The governor created the Criminal Justice Policy Assessment Council, the CJPAC group, in June of 2016, 24, 25 different people from just about every walk of life, not just the criminal justice universe with law enforcement, prosecution, and defense, but you had judges, the courts represented, you had law enforcement, you had the defense bar, but you also had the business community with the chamber, you had the faith community, you had other members of the governor's cabinet, economic development, workforce-related professionals, all these different folks coming from places that aren't normally looking at the justice system.
Right.
And you had people that were really left of center and really right of center that were represented and had a voice in this process. And I think that speaks to the nature of this sort of policy work. In any given policy area, you can do what feels good or you can do what actually works. And in criminal justice policy, we sought out, obviously, to do what works. We wanted to make sure, since it's getting such an enormous part of our tax dollars, John Tilley could throw these numbers off the top of his head now that he's Justice Cabinet Secretary. But, you know, we spend It's not quite approaching $600 million, but it's on its way there, and it could easily get pretty darn close to that number. So half a billion-ish in corrections alone, just for the Department of Corrections to run all the facilities across the state. That's money that we could be spending in other places to get a better return on the investment and a better outcome, most importantly, a better outcome for the Kentuckians involved. 95% of the people in custody today are coming home. At
Absolutely.
Some point, they're going to return to their communities. They're going to return to their families. They're going to return, hopefully, to an environment where they can succeed. And we want to make sure we do everything we can to help that transition be successful. You call it a reentry bill, and I think that's exactly what it is. All those things that you describe are all solid pieces of legislation included in the bill. The licensure bill is something that has taken several years to come through.
Right,
huge. It's enormous. In fact, Secretary Tilley, when he was in the House, filed it. I tried for 2 years or maybe 3 years to get it through the Senate and continue to run into philosophical and other objections to the substance of that, and thankfully muscled it through with Senate Bill 120 with a changeover in the House that I thought was reasonable. In fact, even my good friend and colleague, Senator John Schickel, who makes me look left of center, he voted for the bill in the end.
Yeah.
And he was one of the biggest voices against that licensure part.
Oh,
but
really?
all this is aimed at making sure these people have the best chance at transitioning back into the world that they're coming back home to regardless. One of the biggest things that we do, one of the biggest indicators, if not the biggest indicator of recidivism or the rate that someone reoffends, is whether or not they have a job. So a lot of the things in this bill relate to job training, both inside the prison walls and out. There's one of my favorite parts is something that I believe 40 other states are already doing. This is called the PIE program, Private Industry Enhancement. And it has a couple of other letters in the acronym, but we call it the PIE program. And this allows a company who, so long as they don't compete with anybody, you know, building a widget outside the prison walls in that area, can build a widget factory inside the prison walls for voluntary labor. If inmates want to do that, they have an opportunity to learn a trade, learn a skill, or just, for goodness sake, be exposed to work on a regular basis and learn and develop that routine and that responsibility. They can help pay for their child support arrearages. They can help pay restitution to their crime victims. They can help pay or offset at least a part of the cost of incarcerating them. They really bear that responsibility on their own shoulders while getting the job training and something that they can walk out the door with and say, look, I've got this time on the line doing X, Y, and Z task or job. I've got this experience, and try to get that same job or maybe even with the same widget factory or manufacturer outside the wall. We're all trying to make this as successful as possible for people so that they don't come back. And right now in Kentucky, they come back at a rate of about 40%,
mm-hmm.
and that's unacceptable.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Senator Schickel a little bit, and that's something that I thought was, that's interesting. He's the, I think he was the only no vote on SB 120 in either caucus, Republican or Democrat. And I know that this is something that Democrats from a long way back are familiar with, inter-caucus coalitions that kind of form, and he's a former law enforcement officer, and I know that historically Republicans have been the party, you know, I don't know if this is necessarily totally fair, but in the public imagination, that's been more in line with, mandatory minimum sentencing and kind of these criminal justice things that have caused a few problems in the past.
Sure.
And I guess I'd be interested to hear your take on we have Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, who's a Republican, who's a big supporter of criminal justice reform. And we have you in the state legislature, kind of the development of the Republican caucus along the lines of these issues and how you've worked with your members of your party to kind of move in a different direction on this issue.
It's a process, and it kind of goes back to the part of Jasmine's question that I didn't answer yet, but I certainly intend to answer, and that's some of these things take an enormous amount of time and too long a time. Some of it's educating other caucus members. I mean, you're talking about some issues, and particularly in the criminal justice area, not even all the lawyers are familiar with what happens in a criminal justice case. Jasmine, as a juvenile public defender, you know the system in and out.
Right.
As a former prosecutor, I know the system in and out. Not every other lawyer dabbles in criminal law at all or ever has, or maybe hasn't seen it or dealt with it since they graduated from law school.
Right, that's a really good point.
you've got to bring people up to speed about all the different steps. One of the biggest things that was cut from this bill was the changes to our bail system. We have money bail in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And Jasmine, you're certainly familiar with that. Every day you're familiar
every
with
day.
That. That's right. So you're charged with a crime and the court, is required to look at whether or not you're a risk to flee or a risk to public safety. And our bill was going to be so provocative that we were going to change that to make the judges consider whether you were going to flee and whether you were going to be a risk to public safety, but simply remove the element of money because not everybody has the same amount of money in their pockets. In fact, you've got some people who can make bail now that we don't want to have out. Presumption of innocence, regardless, that everybody in the room, including their own attorney, would rather they stay in because of whatever reason in a given case. But they're able to make bail and get out because they've got financial resources and the homeless person doesn't. AOC came up with numbers that I think are pretty rock solid. That there are about, I think they said, I can't remember how many certain inmates, but you've got thousands and thousands of people that are still innocent under the law. They have not been convicted of diddly squat. And they're sitting in, they are either low or moderate risk. They are not a risk to public safety. They are not a risk to flee. But they're sitting in custody, pre-trial, not convicted, for no other reason than they are too poor to pay their bail to get out.
Right.
They wouldn't run. They wouldn't pose a danger. But they sit there, and they sit there on your dime and mine. And AOC's savings, or cost impact, and what we could save if we did this, was something like $120 million a year. It was a huge number.
And I think a problem in Louisville is judges are very, very reluctant to ever apply bail credit. So even when people should get bail credit, $100 a day towards their bail, they're usually not getting it.
And that brings up an issue that's something we contend with often with justice policy. It's the same in juvenile justice issues as well. It's justice by geography. And you have that. And anytime you have discretion in the system, you're going to have it. And we can't eliminate discretion entirely.
Right.
And I don't just mean judges. You can find it in a number of points in the process or in the justice system, at the juvenile adult levels both.
Right. At the court designated worker level for juveniles, prosecutors, just about any level.
You can find it at every level. And that discretion is important. If you take away discretion, then you have things like mandatory minimums, which have incredibly negative outcomes, and you hamstring the process or the system and the people like prosecutors and judges who use that discretion wisely and appropriately. So it's a careful balance when you write legislation, when you look at how discretion fits in. But going back to what I originally started to say, You gotta educate everybody about what bail is about, what it means, and then mechanically how bail is sought, when it's, and I learned, and as much as I dealt with it, even I learned some things in here over the course of it with conversations with district court judges and AOC, and specifically the mechanics of how pretrial release officers conduct, not just how they conduct their assessments, but how things are communicated to judges and when the decision is made and when. You know, as a prosecutor, I'd show up on a day of arraignment, and one of my circuit judges refused to take up bail motions for bond or bail adjustment until after arraignment. One would do it at arraignment, but we wouldn't know anything about the case necessarily, certainly not the bail conditions. If it changed between district court and circuit court, whatever was noted on the file, it was eye-opening for me, and I see this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to educate the other attorneys, the other 120 some odd other members of the legislature, and then help them all to understand the process and critically make sure their constituents back home that deal with this every day, their judges, their prosecutors and county and Commonwealth's attorneys, their public defenders, their social workers, their judges in particular, all are okay with it because those judges know their senators and representatives' numbers more than I know those judges' numbers. And if something's out of step, they'll let us know. And, you know, sometimes things just take way too much time. We cut those two pieces out, the bail provision and the increased felony theft threshold for theft. It raised from 300 to 500 not long after I joined the prosecutor's office in 2007 in Hoptown, and then it's been at 500 ever since. We're Tennessee's at 500, but we're at the bottom end of the country. Mm-hmm. Texas, a red, red state outside of, I guess, Houston and Austin and San Antonio, maybe. But red state, not known for being soft on crime, as John Tilley and I both like to joke, has it at $2,500.
Oh, wow.
We had originally proposed in the draft at, a felony theft level at 2,000. I would have been happy with any increase at
any,
all.
Yeah, any increase, I would take it.
But, again, you try to balance concerns of the various constituencies. And this, to get into the weeds just a little bit, and for those of you non-lawyers and who don't deal with criminal practice, this is going to just bug you because it'll be Greek to you. But in Kentucky, if you've been charged with a misdemeanor, your cost is almost entirely always at the county level and charged to the county. If you're charged with a felony, even if you have tag-along misdemeanor charges, but if you're charged with a felony and you're sitting in the county jail, the county's paying for it, but they get reimbursed by the state until you're convicted, and then you're on the state's dime.
Right.
The fiscal arrangement that exists between county inmates and state inmates in county jails and what your charges are is so daggum complicated that it really hangs us up. If you increase the felony theft threshold from $500 to even $1,000, much less $2,000, you just created a bunch more misdemeanors. Yeah. And that's a higher cost to counties, even if they save money by not having those extra felons now. So you've saved the state some money, but you've put that cost off the state's shoulders and now onto the county's shoulders. Mm-hmm. And you balance that with the fiscal concerns of, apart from the philosophical concerns people have, and there are some on the theft, not as many. There were a lot of hesitation on the bail just because it was new, not necessarily outright objection to it on principle, just because nobody had talked about it before. Mm-hmm. And it was a new thing. In fact, the only other state that's done it that I'm aware of is New Jersey. And we looked at New Jersey's for how we would shape ours, at least in some part. But that cost on whether or not inmates are released and when they're released, all of that comes into play, and we just couldn't make it work. Mm-hmm. Couldn't make everyone satisfied enough that it wouldn't cause one group or another to blow the bill up and kill it.
Right.
And as you mentioned just a few minutes ago, things like the licensure part of this bill, that part of the bill alone was worth not letting it get blown up and stopped.
Right.
I agree with that for sure.
It was either get a little bit that was really, really good, or sacrifice the good for the perfect, which we could not achieve.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I wanted to move on and talk about another bill, HB 333. Obviously, you were not the sponsor of this one because it's a House bill, but you did vote for it. This bill limits the amount of opioid painkillers a physician can prescribe at one time, and it also increases the sentences for those trafficking fentanyl. So this law makes sharing any amount of heroin a Class C felony with a 5 to 10 year sentence, even if the person that's sharing is an addict themselves. A lot of people believe that the passage of this bill is maybe a step backwards from HB 463, which for the listeners, I've talked about this before. This was kind of a landmark criminal justice bill that steered nonviolent drug offenders into treatment rather than long-term incarceration. Talk a little bit about your vote in favor of this bill and what this law means for the future of HB 463 and criminal justice reform.
Well, I'd be glad to. I did vote for it, as did all but nine senators, and I think only one no vote in the House. I think the reason for that is because people were out of ideas about what else to do about the trafficking that goes on. You mentioned sharing, and that's certainly an example of a possible outcome here, but the bill relates to trafficking, and not every trafficking case is sharing. And this is where, Jasmine, your inner and very still active public defender is going to go against my inner prosecutor.
Probably.
But, and I recognize that sharing goes on. Obviously, it goes on. You hear cases. You see those cases every day. I saw them to a lesser extent, but saw them with cocaine and meth back in Christian County at the time before heroin became a deal down there. but it happens. But that's not the only sense of trafficking that goes on. And the definition of trafficking is the transfer, whether without whether for consideration or not. It doesn't have to be the TV or movie kind of idea of a trafficking operation. And in fact, for those listening, most of the trafficking cases aren't like that. They're smaller quantities for cash or something. They are not big truckloads that you see in CSI Miami or something like that.
Definitely.
So it does reverse course in some respect on that. But I think it's because we've done as much as we can do, at least in some folks' eyes, without getting too lenient on traffickers. And I'll come back to a distinction I want to make there in a minute. But we tried 463 in this particular area, yet we continue to see growing trafficking, growing use, and certainly, as we saw reported last week, a growing and tragic number of overdose deaths because of it, and overdoses because of it. Heroin and fentanyl, both in fentanyl and carfentanil after that, which are enormously even more powerful and potent than heroin. In fact, law enforcement are being taught nationwide not to touch it, not to conduct field tests on it. Mm-hmm. If they can identify it, or if they know that it's fentanyl and it's dangerous because it's often pressed into pill form by presses you can buy on eBay today, and don't ask me why that's available, but they can't know that it's fentanyl, and they get, I mean, you've heard of cases, and there's been one here in Kentucky where an officer's been grown sick. I don't know if he's died, but I know that an officer was injured because of just a contact high from fentanyl. It's so strong. Going back to the distinction, though, I want to make, and this is the rub, and I had heartburn about it as a prosecutor, but as a policymaker, I understand what the legislature was trying to get at. There's a reason why in 463 they made a distinction between a bigger trafficker and someone who's just a peddler.
Okay, right. I wanted to ask you about that. I figured that's where you were going.
Yeah, the statute doesn't use the word peddler, right? Or at least 463 did, but that's the common vernacular for what we're trying to describe here, and would describe what you, I think, at least could arguably describe the sharing sort of scenario you just talked about.
Yes.
In my experience, Jasmine, and it may differ from yours greatly, in my experience, while there are some addicts who peddle in drugs, most aren't an addict themselves because they can't be an addict. They can't keep the product that they're addicted to without consuming it. If they had any quantity enough that they could traffic in it, they'd consume it, may even kill them. It's just not something that happened often. Now, they may be rinky-dink and podunk of a trafficker, but I don't often see a trafficker who's also an addict in that particular substance, whether it's heroin or meth or cocaine or whatever. There was a school of thought at the time to make that distinction. But if you had legislators, and I think even Secretary Tilley would tell you, if you had legislators from 2011 here on the podcast to say, they drew a line for heroin at 2 grams arbitrarily. There's no science to say it should be 2 grams instead of 3 or 4 like it is for cocaine. It's at 4 or meth at 4. They just drew a line somewhere to try to draw a distinction, but you know what happened. You got dealers out there, rinky-dink, peddler, podunk dealers, who still get people addicted, who still traffic in this substance that's so deadly, who would traffic in 1.9
grams.
Right,
they know the amount to stay
under
that.
And it doesn't, so long as there's an amount, there will be people who'd sell under it. It doesn't matter where we drew the line. That was going to happen, and it did happen. And so there was a sentiment to just muscle back up on penalties for traffickers alone for heroin and fentanyl for these most serious of drugs. And I think the support you saw from people who ordinarily wouldn't have been for something like that speaks for how desperate we are to try something. But I want to say this. Do this all day long. Hammer those traffickers all day long. Trust law enforcement and prosecutors to make the right calls on the discretion that they have, going back to discretion again, about whether or not trafficking is the right charge. And they have that power. They can decide not to charge trafficking because they realize it wasn't a trafficking in the traditional sense people think of. They can charge possession. They can amend down. They can divert, if it's amended down to a D, the whole host of things they can do because of their discretion. We need to trust them to do that. But at the same time, if we're going to hammer traffickers, we can't just do that. We have to increase access to care. Mm-hmm. And since 2011, Kentucky's increased its treatment capacity by 12 or 14 or maybe 1,500%. And as I sit here recording this with you today on July 5th, we still haven't met the demand for it.
Right.
There are still needs for it, and particularly in the juvenile community, and not just substance, but also mental health, behavioral health. And if we can divert some of the resources to those things or just put new money towards those things, and we did that in the 2015 bill. We spent $10 million. That was dropped in there in 2015, and Governor Bevin doubled it in last year's budget and put all new money toward it on top of the 10. So we're doing that, but we have to keep making that investment because that's money well spent. In drug court programs, you mentioned in the highlights of the bill, one of the things was the drug reentry program. It was recommended by one of the state reps from over in Boyd, Greenup County, northeastern Kentucky, near Ashland. It was Lou Nichols, who was a former circuit judge and won a special election last year, but then lost in the general with the Trump wave, I suppose. He recommended it during the summer and brought it to the Judiciary Committee, and I liked it. It was like drug court, but at the back end of the process, and I said, let's put that in the bill.
Yeah, I was at a wedding 2 weeks ago that Senator Nichols actually did. So yeah, he's a good person, and yeah, that's good to hear that you guys are working together on that. He's a charismatic.
Not all Republicans and Democrats hate one another.
Right.
And if the listeners get nothing else from this conversation, I hope they get that.
Yeah.
That progress doesn't happen in a vacuum, and we can't just seal ourselves off. Not all great ideas come from Republicans, and not all great ideas come from Democrats or bad ones from either party either. The dating violence bill,
yep.
I didn't know that was an issue until I got here. It's my prime example. You talk about things that were long in the coming and take a lot of time to educate people and bring people up to speed. It took 9 years
mm-hmm.
for that bill to pass. I was the first Republican to give it a hearing
right.
in the Senate in 2013. And I kept pushing until we got it through.
Right.
It takes that sort of effort, but that was a Democrat bill. House Bill 40, the expungement bill, both of which, by the way, I fought really hard to make sure they remained House Democrat bills because they're the ones who filed them.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't file those. I'm not going to try to take those bills. If we don't see the common areas and find ways to work towards those things, we're just making life worse, and mm-hmm. I get enough of that in my Twitter feed as it is.
Well, we're actually already over time, but if we want to talk about SB 200 really quickly, we can do that.
It's a good bill.
Yep.
So you sponsored Senate Bill 200 in 2014, which made some pretty significant changes to the juvenile justice system, including a mandatory diversion program for first-time misdemeanor offenses and some other things like putting time limits on probation and commitment to the Department of Juvenile Justice. For the listeners, Yvette De La Guardia and I just did a show on some of these things with Senate Bill 200 a couple weeks ago, so you can go back and listen to that to get up to speed. But the state has seen a reduction in juveniles in Department of Juvenile Justice detention facilities, and they've even closed some of their facilities. Could you talk a little bit about the results that we've seen from Senate Bill 200?
In short, the results have been really, really strong. We've cut juvenile dockets in half. We've diverted a number of kids. 90% of the kids that would have ended up, I'm going to try to get this number right, 90% of the kids that would have ended up in court have been diverted, and half of those have been successful. Almost half of those have been successful. That means almost half of the kids that would have ended up in court didn't.
Right.
And they've been good for and they're better for it. One of the biggest things that Senate Bill 200 was aimed at doing is getting these kids into programs and treatment resources early on, and that early intervention so that they never see a courtroom. Because once a kid sees a courtroom, they are more likely to come back. And those kids that show up in juvenile court or stay on a docket for a long time and end up doing things that kids do and just be dumb growing up kids
mm-hmm.
And make mistakes, they're scrutinized and hammered even more, often more harshly than their adult counterparts for the same conduct. You know, one of the most jarring stats that we saw in Kentucky was that our kids that commit violations, you know, you got felonies, misdemeanors, violations, violations are punishable by a fine, but the kids that commit violations and misdemeanors were held out of home, were held within less than 30 days of the same amount of time as the kids that committed felonies.
Yeah.
Which is insane. And it costs us up $20,000+ per bed per year to house an adult. In Kentucky, it costs us over $100,000 per bed per year to detain a kid. And it's worse in the long run to boot. There was a quote, I know we're running long, so I'll just leave you with this. The state should be very proud of the work that it did. I sponsored the bill, and it took a lot of work for me, but it took a lot of work from a whole bunch of other people, left, right, middle, everybody, to get that bill through. But it's been used in West Virginia, South Dakota, maybe even Idaho, Kansas, maybe Oklahoma. There's another one I'm drawing a blank on, but they have borrowed whole chapters of our bill because of its success. And if I can leave your listeners with one thing about juvenile justice that drives what I do, it's this. A quote from Frederick Douglass: it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. And that's why that bill is so important.
And we're certainly super thankful for your work on that. When you talk about juvenile justice in Kentucky, I think your name is usually the first one that comes up. And you've been kind of a juvenile justice
for
champion
better,
for us. So we're really proud of the work that you've done on that. Are there any other juvenile justice or just criminal justice issues in general that you'd like to see addressed in future legislative sessions?
There are several. The biggest one, without question, is disproportionate minority contact, disproportionality.
Yes, thank you.
In Jefferson County in particular, in the 15-16 school year, there were 1,500 school complaints. 1,200 of those were on black kids. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind that the demographic share of the population is about 80% white and 10 or 15% black.
Mm-hmm.
But 1,200 out of 1,500 complaints were on black kids. On truancy, 44% were on black kids, 43% on white kids. On assault of or abuse of a teacher, assault third, which is the only Class D felony Kentucky has, it's you got to be a special victim, class of victim, to have a defendant charged with that. Teachers in that group. So abuse of a teacher, assault third, disorderly conduct, the amounts were actually the reverse of their demographic share. So 80% of the charges in those cases were on black kids and 10% were on white kids.
Yep.
There's bias in the system somewhere. Yeah. Now, where in the points of contact that there are for juvenile justice that it's coming up, we don't know. Yeah. But that's a problem that's got to be addressed. It's been around for a long time. I had a bill this year that failed frustratingly. I could go another 3 hours talking about that thing that failed, but the agencies have agreed to do what I was going to ask them to do without the legislative mandate. So we're going to have a whole host of data in the next year or two to inform policies that no one can say no to, because the data is going to be, or at least I hope that, I'm sure somebody will still try. But I'm going to try to convince them that the data is too compelling not to act, because it's there and we have to eliminate it. It's just crazy.
Yep. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and discussing all these issues with us. You know, like Jasmine said, we really appreciate all the work that you've done on this issue. It's obviously you're very passionate about it, and we're very passionate about criminal justice and juvenile justice here at My Old Kentucky Podcast. And, you know, the next year the session's twice as long, so hopefully we'll get twice as much accomplished. So looking forward to seeing what we have in store then as well. So thanks again for coming on. And
appreciate the invite.
Yeah, and we will hopefully talk to you again soon. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, Jasmine. Tell the people how they can get in touch with us.
They can find us on Twitter at @MyOldKYPod. They can like our Facebook page. We post our show notes on Medium. And you can find our podcast on the podcasting app of your choice.
Okay, everybody, thank you very much. And we'll see you next week.